This is a recording from Reunions Weekend 2011 at the University of Virginia, made possible by the UVA Alumni Association. This session is a panel discussion from the class of 1981.
Thank you all for coming today. My name is Stuart Doyle, class of 81, and I have the pleasure and the honor of facilitating our discussion today. I want to welcome each of you here and thank you for attending Reunions Weekend as well as this event in particular. We have an illustrious panel of alumni before us, and if you've read their bios in advance, you will see that they have collectively a very diverse and eclectic background, and I personally think that their backgrounds are a testament to UVA's focus on getting good results from very well-rounded students, because again, their backgrounds are so diverse. It basically says that you don't have to just major in law or engineering or, you know, what we consider traditional UVA majors, because we all can become superstars in our own right by doing the things that we love to do. During this hour-long interview, if you've read their bios, you will see that, and I mentioned it to some of them, that we could actually interview each of these people for an hour alone. So I feel like you're going to get cheated to some degree, because we may end up with a lot more questions that you have. But during this time that we have together, we'll try to get as much out of it as possible. The ideal takeaway from this session today will be something that we're calling the three E's, and that's a little bit of education through the experiences of these alumni, and hopefully some personal enlightenment for you by what they share, and if nothing else, just some plain old entertainment. I'm sure that they're going to be good for a few laughs, so we hope to have a lot of fun today as we go along. Now, just some brief introductions. We have Val Ackerman. Val, raise your hand. Val is just very briefly adjunct professor in Columbia University Sports Management Program and former president of the Women's National Basketball Association. Teresa Bryce Bazemore, president of Radian Guarantee, which is a company that helps mortgage lenders sleep better at night. Radian provides private mortgage insurance to protect lenders from default-related losses, and Teresa might elaborate somewhat on that as we go along, because that is what we call in my field corporate speak, okay? We have Kelly Darden, who is in his 28th year with the FBI, and presently as an assistant special agent, he oversees the Bureau's Miami field office. We have Mike McQuarrie, who to me it seems that he's a man of a thousand trades. He's probably most noted for his role in co-founding Mindspring.com. And lastly, we have Jahan Ramazani, who's on faculty in UVA's English department, and he is the one on this panel who can speak to an experience as both a UVA student and a professor. So anybody with prospective wahoos, you may want to listen to him very carefully, listen to any advice that he wants to share about, for students really who are going to be attending the university in years to come. Now, I'm going to start off with a few general questions for our panel, and I'm going to sort of do a little retrospective here, a little walk down memory lane, and I'm going to begin with Teresa and Val, and I'm going to ask you, what are your most vivid and special memories from your days on grounds? How about Val? Let's start with you.
Okay, so Mike, can everybody hear me? I guess I would say probably for all of us, the bookends of first and last year for me. I mean, moving into the dorm first year, I remember when my parents dropped me off and drove away, and I was left wondering what I was going to do now, because we didn't have cell phones then. So, you know, the next time I got to talk to them was the next Sunday, standing in line at the payphone at the end of the dorm hall for the collect call home. You know, that's how it was done. So it was very traumatic, and I do remember that. I come from New Jersey, you can probably tell by my accent. I was in the old dorms, and I remember the Confederate flag hanging out of the dorm room windows for the boys' hall, wondering what that was all about. And I came from a public high school in New Jersey, and I sort of showed up in my jeans and clogs, and remember seeing these elegantly dressed women my age wearing pearl necklaces and madras skirts and espadrilles, and I had to sort of fight through all of that, but I had an amazing first year here. I was an athlete, and I would say my experience here really was defined by being a student athlete, and the prism of playing sports and dealing with that was one of my most vivid memories. I remember being in TJ's a lot. I guess it's still here, right? No, it's something else. It's a bar, but called something else. And then, the bookend concludes with my fourth year. I got to live on the lawn, and it was just an amazing experience. And I would sort of sum up by saying the sense of the place here. I think that, the memory of being here and seeing the rotunda whenever you were walking down to the corner and being on the lawn, and even if you were off grounds driving up to the mountains, and the memory of the effects of the place on you, it was like a restfulness for me to be here. And whenever I come back, I feel that same sort of sensation. So those, I guess, would be my top memories.
And while some of you are putting your cell phones on mute or vibrate, Teresa, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Well, like Val, I remember moving into the dorm first year and meeting some of the folks that are in here, including Phil Katz back there. But just having so much fun. I remember we were in the in Dunnington in the Eccles Scholars dorm. I remember the four-year Eccles parties that were interesting that we had to plan. And I remember pledging my sorority and having to walk in a line all over the grounds. But one of the things I think that was so important for me was I was in resident staff for 3 years. And that was a wonderful experience. I got to know Wayne Cozart really well during that time. I do have sort of a funny story. My father, who wanted me to stay at home, I'm an only child, he decided he would offer me a car to go to ODU. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. But something happened my first year as an RA, and there was something wrong with the ringer on my phone. And so I wasn't hearing the phone ring at night. And I come home from some session where we're learning what to do as an RA, and my parents are standing outside of my suite. I thought someone had died. And they were like, you're not answering your phone. And my mother said, all I heard all the way here was if she had at least gone to William and Mary, it would have been a shorter drive. But I remember, just how many great friends that I got here and how warm everyone was and just the ability to feel like you could do anything that you wanted to do while you were here and really the opportunity for student leadership. And those are the things that I remember.
Well, I think, panel, we've accomplished our entertainment piece, so that's one down. Now, let's take a look at some of the long-term effects that UVA have had on your lives. Let's go back to Teresa and Val and look at what you would do differently if you could return to 1977 and start first through fourth year again. Let's start with Teresa on this one.
I guess the first thing I would do is, I shied away from taking sort of the large classes. I had this sort of feeling that being in a room with 300 other people wasn't the best way to go. And what I learned later was that it was all about how wonderful the professor was. And so, I missed out on having Elzinga and Bice because I was so focused on the smaller classroom experience. That's certainly one of the things that I would do differently, I think.
And Val?
Well, there's an expression, youth is wasted on the young, right? Now I know what this means. And while I think I did my best because, again, I was a student athlete and you really didn't have much time for anything outside of the student and the athlete part, I look back now and there were so many things that I wish I could have done or maybe had tried harder to do in terms of other activities. I mean, the treasure trove here of organizations and people to meet and courses to take, I think when you're sort of caught up in your world, it's sort of hard to, and you don't have the energy sometimes to sort of do all that, but I think if I could do it all over again, I would try maybe a few less hours of sleep, maybe, and try to do more of the great activities that are available here for all the students.
Now, Kelly and McHugh, we're going to call Michael Corey McHugh for this exercise. Tell us from your end, particularly considering the somewhat non-traditional for UVA, at least, career paths that you've taken. How did your UVA experience influence any of your life and career choices? Let's start with Kelly.
Non-traditional, eh?
Not law, you're not law engineer. No, you are law. Okay, but not, yeah.
I was just going to say, yeah. Bob Mueller, our director, is a graduate of law school.
Yeah.
So. Back when I first met Bob Mueller, well, I didn't first meet him, but I met him then at Gitmo. We had an operation down there. I looked at him and I said, wahoo wah. And everybody else looked at me like, what did you say? And he kind of smiled like, yeah. So that helped prepare me for my, learning what a wahoo was. Actually, to tell you the truth, coming to UVA, the sense of student independence, the focus on service, the fact that I was a chair along with Phil Katz and Peter Mahoney and the resident staff. We also worked with Wayne Kozart very closely, along with other great administrators. It's still your sense of service, that you wanted to do something, give back to your country, and that's what motivated me. Actually, I ended up in the FBI kind of as a second choice. I was actually prepared to go into the military as the Army lawyer, and one day in the Washington Post, I saw an article that talked about training at Quantico. And I thought, gee, this is interesting. Let me check this out. And here I am, almost 28 years later. The other thing is having been a member of a fraternity, the sense of service, camaraderie, the fact that you have to learn to get along with a group of folks who may have different ideas, but together with a common purpose, you're able to accomplish goals and objectives. And as you know, in any group, you're always going to have differences. Having been a member of Madison House, a board of directors, again, that sense of service, the fact that for the first time in a lot of students' lives, they have the sense of freedom and independence that they didn't know at home. And so you really have to be careful how you handle that freedom. And if I could be funny, maybe not as funny as Val and Teresa, but being a resident advisor, I remember my guys taking me water skiing. Some of you guys laugh, like, you must know what that is. And I told them, I said, I will kill you, as they held me over the urinal in the toilet. The water skiing was, we're going to get your feet wet, and then we're going to turn you upside down. And but I think my firm voice let them know, this is not a good idea, guys. Or the day, that night, that the firecracker came under my door and I tried to study and scared me to wits. But most troubling was one of my guys who, in the nude, in the hallway, was passing gas and was able to light the train without singeing himself. What have we come to? Clearly, he wasn't handling his independence very well, but I understand. This individual went on to become a doctor, so. No, just recall, no, this was when I was in RA, so this individual would have been a year at least behind me. So. Had you heard there, didn't I? Sorry.
McHugh, let's hear from you.
I don't know if some of you read the bios, but I'm most excited to hear from Jahan a little bit. I, as somewhat of an amateur practitioner myself, I had no idea he was one of the foremost experts in the world at post-coital poetry. Oh, never mind. Post-colonial. My bad.
This is going downhill.
Just as impressive, but I'm much less interested. My undergraduate career here was checkered. There was that first year, that whole getting up, I thought I was brilliant, scheduling, you know, 8 o'clock class, a 9 o'clock class, being done with it for the day. That was strategically a big train wreck my first semester. I finally came to terms with how you picked classes here, and that was I would do a lot of research and talk to people, and I would go to the very first class, because I truly believe there were no great classes, but there were great professors. And I would go to the first day, and if the professor was great, I would go to the class. If he wasn't, I would take the final, which is normally 100% of your grade, and it made for some interesting scramble situations throughout my academic career. But it also led me into, and in my search for gut classes, it led me to some great professors. Anybody here take mental health from Doc Brown or rehab techniques? I mean, those guys were entertaining. Bike psychology, I mean, my academic sort of class curriculum sort of reads like a gut manifesto. So when people find out I went to Virginia, a lot of times, you know, people that know about Virginia's academic reputation, they kind of do a double take on me a little bit. And then I explain that I squandered an excellent academic opportunity, but what I got was a magnificent education. And sometimes I think an education doesn't necessarily have to do with what goes on in the walls of the classroom. For me, it was my experience walking on to the wrestling team and being a part of athletics here. It was making great friends first year. Heck, John Quartier and Arlo, I'd see and talk to them, you know, probably on a monthly basis here, and they were in my dorm first year. And that also may be a tribute to the fact that none of us have the social skills to be able to make new friends over the past 30 years. Either way, we're sort of stuck with each other. And it was certainly joining a fraternity and getting, you know, milled in with what that was all about. So, I mean, I think my experience here absolutely shaped who I am. I still have the same short attention span. If it's something that I find interesting, I dive into it. And if it's not that interesting, not so much.
Sounds like an entrepreneur. So tell us what UVA did not prepare you for with you.
You know what, UVA was... It wasn't much of a melting pot, frankly. I mean, when we were here, it was, we had sort of more than our quota of, you know, preppy, privileged, you know, prep school kids. And it was good for me because I didn't know a lot of those people growing up. I mean, so that part was good, but I mean, the misogyny and the fraternities and covert, but sometimes over racism that went on grounds. I mean, you look back and it's, you know, in the anti-gay sentiment, it's all, you know, pretty embarrassing, some of the baggage. And we weren't as cosmopolitan as I think we would have liked to have thought we were. The good part for me is, you know, the drug culture that was rolling around UVA, I was fine with because I went to Midlothian High School in Richmond. So I was prepared for that back then. But I think you got a very narrow view of the world. And for me, it was good because it taught me that, you know, there were some real idiots that had trust funds and they weren't necessarily going to be the people that were going to win in the end of life. So I like the fact that I learned that you could compete with some of those folks. But I mean, it was a fishbowl and it was narrow, and as you move through your career in life, you sort of find out that as much as university is a world-class university, it's come a long way, but we had a little bit of a narrow scope to who we were and what we could have done with that.
Kelly, what's your response to that question, considering your background especially?
As a black man.
Considering your background as a black man.
Is he black? Kelly, go ahead.
You're black.
I know that's upsetting to you, Phil. After all these years. Well, I was concerned about that Confederate flag also, but. Yeah, I was really worried. Anyhow, but actually, I had a sister that had gone here from 71 to 75. And you can imagine it was really rough for her, so she kind of paved the way, and notwithstanding all the problems that she had, I think she was ready to quit maybe 5-6 times, but my dad convinced her to stick with it, and it encouraged me to say, you know, that is where I need to go, because if I can survive Virginia, UVA, then I think I can survive anything as far as being prepared for the world. So I think to that extent, all the issues and problems we had, it was no different than what you were going to face in the real world. So it was actually a good experience in the sense that nothing's perfect. If you survive this, if you make the best of it, you're going to succeed in life because life is just going to be a continuation of what you've experienced here. No different. Faces will change, names will change, but same circumstances. It was great being under the honor system, a sense of trust amongst people that you could leave your stuff wherever you knew it would be there when you got back. The fact that you could take people at their word and they, for the most part, meant it, you know, unless there's a misunderstanding. So, but I think the shortcoming was, in that setting, we were sort of idealistic. We expected that that's how the real world would be. And so I had to adopt the Reagan philosophy, trust but verify. Because when people lied to you, that really disappointed you, and certainly within the FBI, no, people wouldn't lie to you in the FBI. God. I mean, by God, we put people in jail based on what we say. You know, we can take people's rights and liberties away. So that was very troubling once I realized that maybe people have ulterior motives. So from that standpoint, perhaps I was a little bit idealistic the first couple of years, but as I became seasoned and old crusty agent, I realized that, this is real world. Mm-hmm. We're a microcosm of society. So even within the FBI, we have our issues.
Thank you. Jahan, I'm going to ask you to sort of bring us all home. It's 30 years later, and you're representing all of us. So congratulations, Steven Spielberg has chosen an 81 graduate, you, to write about. And his screenplay about your life story is slated to be his next Hollywood blockbuster. And you get to cast the lead. So Jahan, who will play you on the big screen? You're waiting.
Let me think, can we pass this question to someone else? I think I'm the least appropriate person for that question. Can imagine the title, Egghead, in many senses of the term. Let's see, who would play the lead? Somewhere between Omar Sharif and going on to Yul Brynner. I can't. But seriously, I guess the thing about my life is, that it's probably less interesting than the lives of anybody else represented here, because I'm the one who never left, right? I'm probably the only person here who was actually born in the university, right? Because any of you have my dad as a professor. He taught here in the government foreign affairs for a long time and retired about 13 years ago. So I was born in UVA Hospital, and then I, came here kind of reluctantly, I have to admit. I mean, after all, I'd grown up here, I have to go to UVA. So I came here and, entered, I lived in Dunnington, had a terrific time. I think ended up loving it, but I kind of got out of here early, went on to other places because I was a little tired at 21 of living in Charlottesville, I have to admit, having grown up here. Look what happened to me. Here I am, of course, 7 years away in grad school, and from after 5 years, the vantage point of New Haven, Charlottesville looks like this kind of ideal pastoral space that you want to return to at all costs. So I was very lucky to be able to come back. And in terms of this great movie that's going to be made, there are very few exciting episodes in an English professor's life, because most of the time, of course, we're sitting there with a book or a computer in front of us, and I'm sure we've all been to films in which, the camera is focused on the writer at the keyboard. How boring can you be, right? The most exciting kinds of things in movies are obviously going to be action of the kind that doesn't exist in my life, I'm sorry to say. Most of the time, the action that takes place is, discovering a wonderful poem that I get to choose for one of the Norton anthologies and hope that thousands of college students might read someday in between their various binges of other activities. So that kind of rich internal life is exactly what I think you can't really capture on film. So I think I would pass on the Steven Spielberg opportunity. There were a couple of fun episodes. I got to go around the world on semester at sea, teaching on semester at sea. a couple of years ago, which was just a fantastic experience. And you know, to go to 10 countries in about 4 months' time. For those of you who are up to date on this, UVA actually took over this boat some years ago. It sails around the world, and you can go as a lifelong learner, if you like. We had you know, people our age in our classes, as well as regular students from all around the country, including UVA students. So I guess, you know, I got to stand on the Great Wall of China and look at the Taj Mahal, and maybe those are cinematic moments, but they're pretty few and far between.
Okay, panel, be quiet. It's your turn. You're going to cast the role of Jahan Ramadani. Raise your hand. Who do you think should play him? You've really got a whole character description right there. Who should play? Raise your hand. Good. I think Jeremy Irons might be a good one. Okay. We're going to move on to McHugh and Val. Now the year is 2021, and Steven Spielberg Jr. wants to follow up on his dad's work. So where do you hope to be in your life when we celebrate our 40th reunion and Hollywood comes a knocking? Val. Okay, well,
Justin Bieber gets to play me.
I'm down for the 40th reunion, so they can, you know, put me down here. Well, I'm going to be working for McHugh. Give me his card. I'm emailing
him. Right, you like the card.
Right. I'm going to do the card thing. You know, who knows, right? I mean, isn't that sort of the fun of life? You know, we sort of start on these trailheads, and then we just twist and turn, and then we end up someplace. And we never would have guessed 10 years ago that we would have been there, or 20 years ago that we would have been over there. So I see sort of more of the same, from at least for me. You know, I'm guessing that, you know, we're all in our 50s, right? I just said the dirty word. So, you know, I guess it's a decade of transition for all of us. It's the decade where we sort of hope our kids leave the nest. They may be leaving and coming back, so I'm told. So I guess making, you know, hoping that your kids sort of land on their feet, if you have them, and become the independent adults that we all have become, I think hopefully happens in that decade. I expect that we're all probably in varying phases of ramping up in some things and winding down in others. Whether that be in our professional lives, whether that be in our personal lives, you know, we may be moving from income producing pursuits to more service oriented pursuits, or some mix of those. I think, you know, I guess I'm seeing some, you know, I think we're all probably in sort of that phase of our lives there. I think I was commenting to my good friend Ken Newsom up there the other night that I, you know, for me, I just, you know, I don't know, I'm sort of in this forever young thing right now, where I don't think of myself as young in most ways, but I like the idea of continuing to grow, seeking out new things, going to new places, reading books, going to a new movie, trying, you know, not to get too crusted over by life. It's so easy to get crusted, you know? And so I sort of fight that. I live in New York City, so it's very helpful because there's always something going on there. And I think when you have kids, they sort of youngify you. I mean, I wouldn't even know what a, you know, PDA was. I just have to share this. I bought a cell phone some years back, and with my younger daughter, who I think at the time was 8, and I was coming home from the cell phone store, and I was pulling out the Getting Started manual from the little box, and as I was reading the first page, she was already programming, you know, my speed dial, my outgoing message. She had put up the wallpaper already, some little design she chose. And so it's just, you know, the whole notion of technology and trying to stay up on that. So for no other reason, you're at least literate at the dinner table, putting aside what that might do for you in terms of your professional life. So that, and being around young people and at least trying to stay up on the world. And I, you know, finally, I would just say it's a huge world. I mean, I think some combination of being true to our communities and our families and what's close to home is more important as we age, but at the same time, recognizing that we live in a shrinking world, and I happen to do some work in the international area, and I really love that. I mean, I'm on a board where I'm with people from other countries, and very humbling you know, to be the American in the room and to sort of realize that kind of what you said about, you know, when we're here, we think the university is one way, but when we leave, we realize it was really maybe another way. To realize that what we think about the USA isn't necessarily what other people think about us. And I just think that's an important lesson to learn. So sort of having the openness to understand that is something that I strive for and hopefully can continue. And then I'm still going to go to work for McHugh, and he gave me his cards.
Okay, so McHugh, what will she be doing in 2020? What will she be doing?
She'll be the head of electric car sales for my company. Let's see.
Stock options?
Absolutely. It's the only way to make money, I found out. I didn't know what a stock option was when we started Mindspring, but I knew I wanted a lot of them. And that was all right. Over the next 10 years, I think it's interesting, we're 50 now, and I mean, think about this. Thomas Jefferson accomplished more after the age of 50 than he did before the age of 50. Now, I just made that up completely. And I think it's amazing to say Thomas Jefferson's name was something, how it just adds sort of weight to it, but it's still a nice notion, and somebody look that up and find out that's true, because it would be a great line to use, and I used it anyway. But what we've got to have now at this age is we've got to have a bias for action. I mean, we've got to make all of the mistakes we make going forward things that we did, not things that we wish we had done. And we still got a bunch of good years. Y'all look good. I've been worried. I've been around grounds for about a day now, and I keep looking at people, and they look like really old and beat up, and I'm like, damn, is that us? And I'm happy to say that it's not us. And somebody then explained the color coding thing on the thing, so we look good. So be proud out on the lawn. In the next 10 years, I'm going to, about half of you in this room, 5 years from now, will own an electric car. So I started a company, it's called WeGo, and we're selling 100% all electric cars. We just got DOT approved. It's a big thing. The only thing that money has afforded me is, two things. One, to find out what my real drinking limit is. It used to be I'd run out of money before I'd run out of thirst. So money has allowed me to find where that limit is. But the other thing it's allowed me is the ability to do anything. The important thing about money is it gives you freedom. And I only want to work on things that I think can be a big deal and can sort of help in a big way. And I think that we've got serious issues centered around climate control and global warming. And it's sort of like, if you believe it or don't believe it, it's one thing. Somebody said, you know, everybody's a Catholic on their deathbed. You know, people like, I'm a believer now, you know, when they didn't their whole life. Well, even if you don't believe in global warming, you know, let's at least bet on the side that maybe there's something there and maybe we should do something about it. So I think that's a big deal. So I'm going to put a lot of time and energy into doing that. And I'll be back certainly in 10 years for the next reunion. And hopefully, you know, see a lot of your same smiling faces out there. So, but take action. I mean, have a bias for action. I used to think, you know, someday when I'm old and decrepit and sitting on that porch, I want to look back on all these great memories. And I decided, I just want to go straight from the great memories right into the wooden box. So I'm going to skip that, you know, relaxing stage and just have a bias for action. Go places. I mean, I've had the opportunity to go to China probably, you know, maybe 20 times over the last 2 years. And it's astounding what's taking place over there. And It is. You think you know what America's like when you're here, and then you get their opinion over there, and it's just astoundingly how it's different. I know Kenny goes, and some of you. But you know, all this being said, this is always going to be a part of our home. And Wayne says it. Whenever I see Wayne, he always says, "Welcome home." And that's pretty cool. We have a collective experience, and I root for UVA people. I don't know Tina Fey, but I hope she does great. She's a UVA grad. I mean, she could be a nasty, monstrous person, but she went to UVA, so I root for her. I mean, Val, 30 years ago, I was sitting next to Val, I think, over in Cavill Hall, going, "Can I get those notes from you?" Those are pretty good notes. Sometimes you go a long way and spend a lot of time, and he's 100 yards from where he was born. 30 years later, I'm sitting next to Val in a classroom again. Now, this is the comm school, and it's the first time I've ever been in the comm school. I'm sitting in the classroom with him. So just have a bias for action. And remember, Thomas Jefferson accomplished more.
Okay, now at this point, I'm going to branch off into specific questions about the panelists' careers. And we do have time. time. Great. And Val, I'm going to go back to you. I'm going to be doing this more so in alphabetical order. Val, you're more than a triple threat. In the entertainment industry, a triple threat is singer, dancer, actor, whatever. But in your case, you have professional athlete, attorney, college professor, and business executive among as standouts among your many credentials. So first tell us, what prompted your transition from pro ball to law so early on in your career? And then how did academia enter into this mix?
Well, the interest in the law well preceded the pro ball opportunity. You know, when I was here, I was really focused on going to law school. That was always a dream of mine, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. But the gap year that I took when I left UVA was to play on a women's pro basketball team in France. There was no WNBA here, so if you wanted to sort of keep things going, that's what you did. And for me, it was actually less about the basketball. It was the semester abroad I never had for me, you know, because I never had that time when I was playing basketball here, which was in effect a two-semester sport. So for me, it was the deferred time to sort of see the world. And that's really why I did it. The basketball was almost secondary at that point. So I came back to the US and then I went on to law school. So for me, it was, it wasn't really a connection between the two, but they really did come together later on when I left law school and I was looking to get into sports, and I was able to link the two, the sports and basketball side with the law side. And my first job, the job I cared most about after working as a lawyer for a couple of years, being a log in the fire of Wall Street for a couple of years, was as a lawyer at the National Basketball Association. So that's what sort of where it all came together for me. The second part, the academic part, came much, much later for me. That's been relatively new. I teach at Columbia. They have a graduate sports management program. I live up there. I was able to sort of link in. And I would just say about academia, if you have the chance to do that, I would really recommend it. I mean, it's a lot of work to teach. You know, it's not just rolling in to the class and making a couple of comments and then sort of taking Q&A. I mean, you really have to work at this, and you really have to think out how you're going to engage with these students over this period of weeks, how you can get them thinking. You know, my approach as an academician in sports, at least, was to be very practical. I mean, sports, it has its own section of the newspaper every day. So you can walk into a classroom and use, you know, what happened with Tiger Woods last year. Man, we got weeks out of that. Leadership, and this became, okay, what are the leadership decisions? What are the executives at IMG and PGA Tour and Tiger himself all doing? You know, the PR agency, what are they all saying and doing and thinking about how to get this guy out of this jam? So that's the beauty of sports. But for me to have that opportunity to engage with young people and to sort of give back, for me it's a give, academics for me at this point is a give back. It's a way to sort of take, you know, in a modest way what I sort of learned, or, you know, the modicum that I knew, and try to explain that. And I really believe too, and at least in the sports business, there still aren't a whole lot of women at the top levels. The business has changed pretty dramatically since I got into the field 25 years ago. You see more and more women working in sports. There's been an explosion of opportunities in sports. It's, you know, we were talking earlier, it's a business, it's a huge business. There are more women's sports out there now. Collegiate athletic departments are sort of huge. They were tiny when we were here because they all have to do the marketing and the ticket selling and the promotion and the commercial stuff on top of the sports side. So there's so many jobs in sports now. But as you ascend, it does sort of become a pretty much of a male-dominated hierarchy at the top. So I really do try in my way to sort of counsel young women who are moving up, mid-level women who want to move up further, about what it takes to be a leader in the sports business. And so for me, you know, that aspect of teaching and being able, again, like I said before, to engage with young people and feel like you're, you know, sort of passing the torch along, I think is an important contribution that we all can make in whatever fields we're in.
Teresa Bryce-Bazemore, what was your reaction to being named last year by Black Enterprise as one of the 75 most powerful women in business? Were you nominated publicly, or did the magazine independently make its selections?
It was a wonderful recognition, I have to say, but you know, I didn't know anything. Thank you. I didn't know anything about it in advance, and so what I found out later was that someone at my company had actually sent some information to Black Enterprise, but they had done their own research about who was going to be in the list. And the way I found out, I was actually in D.C. on business, and I was working on some emails one night after a dinner, and someone who had retired from our company sent me an email saying, congratulations, with the link to the beta site for Black Enterprise. And I opened it up and I'm thinking, congratulations for what? And I opened it up and that's how I found out. So, I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity, but I think more importantly, I mean, I practiced law for many years before I moved into a business role 3 years ago. And, you know, one of the things I have to credit Madison House with is that I thought I wanted to be a doctor when I first got here. And I volunteered to work in the university operating room. And that, along with organic chemistry, taught me that that was not the thing for me to do in life. So, you know, I ended up going to law school and really sort of enjoyed being a practicing lawyer. But went into corporate America after about 6 years. And that's been a great experience for me. But I think the university also prepared me for that because I'm still in a very male-dominated area, particularly in the mortgage banking field. And I found in private mortgage insurance, which is even a smaller sort of piece of mortgage banking, I'm the only woman to run a company. And there are very few women at the senior ranks at any of the competitors. So that's been, you know, a great experience for me in terms of having sort of the comfort level of being sort of at a place like UVA, feeling comfortable with having leadership roles here, and then being able to take that confidence forward in terms of what I've done since then. I will say that that one of the things that's been really cool for me, probably more cool than the Black Enterprise thing, was I have had a chance to testify in Congress 3 times, and that has been a really cool experience. And luckily, they weren't grilling me. I was actually giving testimony about it that they were considering.
Let's move on to Kelly. And I want to say, lead in by saying that you had a lengthy career with the FBI, like 27 years, which makes you part of the last generation to stay with one employer for more than 20 years, if not for a whole career. And you talked a little bit before about, you know, how you, you know, went into the FBI after UVA, how that evolved. But what are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about the FBI?
First of all, I have no knowledge that J. Edgar Hoover ever wore a dress.
What about the 1890 census? Did the 1890 census really burn, or was Hoover trying to cover something up?
I'm not sure.
I'm being selfish.
This is being recorded, is it not?
Genealogists want to know, anyway.
The misconceptions, first of all, we're not tapping on your phones. We're not listening in to all your conversations through eavesdropping. We're not intercepting all the emails. And I think television certainly has allowed the FBI to be mystified to some extent. So we've tried to, one of the things I've tried to do, and certainly since 9/11, we tried to demystify it somewhat in the sense that we are really trying to focus on not violating people's civil liberties mm-hmm. and rights. So there's a lot. So when we get a wiretap, there's a lot of review through our management structure, of which I'm a part of, through our legal counsel folks, through judges that do independent reviews of these requests. So that if we tap a phone, Brandon, there has been a lot of legal review that goes through that. So I want to disabuse folks of the notion that we're somehow running rampant. Not to say that wasn't a concern in years past, and that's why we saw Congress enact a 10-year limit on the term of the FBI director because of some of the perceived excesses of J. Edgar Hoover. Although it's interesting to note that the president has requested of Congress that our director be extended for 2 more years because of changes in the national security team, and I think in light of things that happened since 9/11, it's probably not a bad idea. So I don't want to get that out of the open. We have through the years become more diverse. We realize that we can only be successful if we are a reflection of what our community at large, the community that we serve, the public. In fact, we are public servants. We work for you guys. You guys pay our salaries. So we have to be responsive to that. We have initiated a number of programs. I think the two biggest things that have had the biggest impact on the FBI would be 9/11 and the introduction of what we call our citizen academies and alumni groups. That is, we bring in citizens for 8 to 10 weeks, expose them to the FBI, and then they basically become alumni of that group. They incorporate, and then they do a lot of service projects throughout the community and work very closely with the FBI. And so having people like that who can go out and help demystify has been a very great move for us, and I think it's probably been one of the greatest impacts on our organization. I'm glad to have citizens involved with the FBI.
Thank you. McHugh, in the early 90s, when the internet became accessible to everyone, did you at that time envision the shift to online communications and the technological advancements that we have now?
Yeah, I mean, from the first time I sort of saw the internet, I knew it was going to be a big deal. It was hard to explain to people what it was in the early days, but it just seemed to me there's this huge repository of information and a new means of communication with email that just seemed inherently logical to me, that if we could just make it easy enough for the layperson to be able to do it, and you didn't need to be a computer programmer, it would happen. And when Mark Andreessen, you know, launched his first web browser, and you could actually hyperlink, and there were graphics, that's what really transformed it. I mean, and up until then, it was just graphic and menu-driven, and it was, you know, really difficult to navigate. And when that, you know, we were about a year before that happened, and when that happened, the thing took off, and it was really just a matter of trying to keep up with it. And it's amazing if you look back at, you know, some of the things we take for granted, and some of the students now do on a day-to-day basis. I mean, Val is, and a couple of panelists have mentioned cell phones. I mean, we didn't have cell phones when we were on campus. I don't know that it would have been, on ground, sorry. I didn't know if it would have been a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know if it would have been a good thing or a bad thing, but I asked some people last night, and I would ask all of you, and everybody says, boy, if we had cell phones, that would have been great. Would you have traded the ability to have cell phones and texting just like they have now for a drinking age of 21? I'm sitting here telling you that our college experience was probably more dramatically different than the students of today, solely because of that drinking age, more so than any kind of technology. So while the technology has certainly been transformative, and I mean, it's amazing what's going to happen in terms of globalization as the next step of technology. I mean, there aren't going to be barriers other than really political barriers to our ability to communicate and get things done worldwide. And I think that's going to be the next transformative step. Is it's a global community, and yeah, we've got pockets of political disagreement that have got to be ironed out, but I think the next revolution is truly going to take place with technology on a global scale, and that's going to open up things for, you know, there's going to be legal questions on how things, you know, our copyright laws are different than other people's copyright laws, so the lawyers are going to have a field day about some of this, and there'll be all sorts of, you know, regulatory and legal jobs that spring out of that. But globalization is the next thing that is going to be embraced everywhere in terms of some of the technology that you're going to see evolving. And the good news, I still get to see some of it. I was like the third, I got to do a trial on Facebook. The Facebook guys called me and said, would you mess around with this for a few weeks and tell me what you think is good and bad about it? So I still get to do some of that stuff. And there's some really cool stuff coming up. And a lot of it, though, is going to your point, the FBI is not watching your every move, but you shouldn't hire anybody until you go look at their Facebook site. I mean, it's amazing what people post out there for the world to see in terms of YouTube, in terms of Facebook. Plotsky's up there now putting Val on YouTube. I mean, the visibility that people have into what you're doing and the sense of privacy, I mean, our kids just kind of don't get it that they're out there for the world, and it's hard to undo and get some of that stuff back. I mean, I was fortunate. Were any of you in Fort Lauderdale after our second year down at the Button? I was very fortunate. It's rumored that I took part in some sort of a wet willy contest down there. And to this day, that's just a rumor because we didn't have phone cameras and videos and all the rest of it. And just for the record, and I've wanted to say this for 30 years, it was really cold and drafty up on that side.
Jahan.
Well, it's not
that we're being recorded, so we know that he did it. Jahan, what do you say to people who either dismiss or discount the value of a liberal arts degree in today's marketplace? We hear so much emphasis on information technology, the sciences, STEM. You know. So what do you say to people who dismiss the value of a liberal arts degree?
Well, I think people like you are probably the best evidence that a liberal arts education, doing something that seems seemingly so useless as getting a BA in English, can in fact be extremely powerful. If you know, it's your one opportunity to expand and open your mind to such a great extent, it seems to me. Through study and analysis of different cultures, languages, all the rest, and through that, to get to know yourself. It doesn't seem that we, to me anyway, and maybe I'm in the minority here, that we have an overabundance of people who are really good at writing in our culture right now, and it's becomes ever more obvious as we all communicate with one another by email constantly, you know, and various other forms of writing, just how vitally important that training is. And if you don't get it when you're an undergrad, you're going to be hampered through the rest of your life. So I think the writings and communication skills, the rigorous analysis and self-reflection that comes through liberal arts education and exposure to a multitude of different areas, so that you become someone who can learn and interpret and broaden and develop throughout a lifetime. I mean, you know, when I was on, for a while I was on our local Rhodes Scholarship Committee, and you know, not to put down some of the other more kind of, how shall we say, clearly directed kinds of study that one can pursue. But, you know, when I would talk to fourth year students who had, you know, chosen one of the more kind of, sometimes kind of vocational forms of training, as it were, often I was kind of aghast because they were just as smart as the other students. But they didn't know very much. I was about to say they didn't know anything. That would be really unfair. But sometimes I was a little aghast. You don't know anything. What have you been doing here for 4 years? You know, this is the opportunity to really kind of develop the groundwork for all different kinds of knowledge and learning the rest of your life. So, I mean, those are some of the things that I would say.
Val, let's go back to you. Now, I'm sure that most of us could not begin to imagine what the feeling is like to have contributed to the success of an Olympic winning team, but you've had this experience multiple times, so tell us about it. Like, after one or two Olympic wins, does it become just ho-hum, blasé, just another gold medal, Val, or seriously, what were those experiences like?
Well, let me answer it first by just sort of giving you sort of making clear the disclosure of the limits of my role on this, although I certainly wasn't on the court doing this, and I can only imagine, I can't imagine what it would be like to be an athlete winning a gold medal, but I, you know, I'll just give you the context for this. When I was at the NBA starting out, I had the fortune of being involved with the first dream team, men's professional team, that went and played in the Olympics in Barcelona. You know, we may all remember the time when the Olympics were sort of amateur only, at least in the sport of basketball, and around the time that I began working at the NBA, the International Basketball Federation, which controls Olympic eligibility, made the determination that the competition should be opened up. So it meant no longer would the USA be sending the college guys, but instead they would be sending the pros. And I was the liaison at that time between the NBA and the national governing body, which was then called Amateur Basketball Association of USA. That name got changed and it became USA Basketball. And I was one of the links behind the scenes, helping with the planning that led to that first team of NBA players appearing in Barcelona. And I mean, it was so crazy to be part of that. I mean, it was just amazing. This was a rock band. You know, we were in Barcelona, and you know, the fans would swarm the bus. And it was just an amazing thing. And then I served in a similar role with the 96 Olympic team. At that time, the NBA was involving itself with women's basketball, and the 96 USA women's team won the gold medal in Atlanta. And I have been involved mostly on the women's side ever since with the USA effort in the Olympics, including in the 2008 Olympics. I was at the time serving as the president of USA Basketball, so I had the opportunity to be in Beijing while our men's team and our women's team both won the gold medals. And I expect I'll be in London next summer. And I would just tell you, back to my earlier comments, it's very, you know, when you're standing in a sporting event and you're in another country and the Star Spangled Banner, you know, we all think we're beyond that. You know, we're cynics. But when you're standing in a foreign gym, you know, and the Star Spangled, and the flags go up, and they're playing the Star Spangled Banner, and you're seeing the Team USA getting the medals, I mean, a tear is coming to your eye. I don't want to sound like a sap, but it's really, you know, we don't think of ourselves as all that nationalistic, I guess, you know, when we're sort of work, you know, day to day. But when you're in that setting, it's very, very powerful, and there's something, you know, you feel really proud, especially when your team represents itself in the right way. I mean, the USA men's team hasn't always had a, you know, sort of a good outing. I was at Athens when Team USA did not win. In fact, I think we got the bronze medal that year. We had a team that was roundly criticized on the men's side, and it needed a cleanup and fast, and it fortunately happened. But you were aware of how scrutinized these athletes are because it's a global world, because it's a technologically wired world now. Nothing is a secret. You know, these guys are under an incredible microscope. But I would say it's just an incredible feeling of pride to be associated with the U.S. Olympic effort. And, you know, it remains as commercial as it is, and as sort of it's been fraught with problems. You know, the IOC and now FIFA and all of these IFs are sort of getting themselves in trouble with bidding improprieties and so forth. But it really remains really one of the great events of the world are these Olympic events, and to be part of that is actually very exciting.
Thank you. Teresa, we're gonna move on to you, and this is gonna be very important for the audience because someone acknowledged a little earlier that all of us are like 30 plus in age. So, now I read a while back that it's common for people to make significant career changes when they reach their 40s and 50s because by this point in life, they have grown up, quote unquote. They know themselves, they know about life, they're less influenced by parental and peer pressures, and they have the confidence to take charge of their lives. And this article also indicated that professionals make the greatest career and life achievements during and after this period. So Teresa, you made a significant change after a 24-year law career upon assuming your current role as president of Radiant Guaranty. So what motivated you to transition from law into a top corporate leadership role?
I wish I could say it was me that was motivated to do it, because I think it's more like what Val was talking about, is that when you look forward, you don't know how these things are going to turn out in your life. I actually decided, I don't have the kind of entrepreneurial sort of bones in my body that Mike does, but I decided to leave Bank of America about 10 years ago and to do a startup with some folks that I had worked with before. And we developed this startup and then sold it to MBNA, which then promptly sold itself to Bank of America. And I decided, okay, well, I've been very active in the mortgage industry. I've been on the board of the Mortgage Bankers. This was a time for me to sort of look and use my connections to think about what else I wanted to do. And I ended up deciding to go to Radiant just because it was the opportunity for me to be GC of a publicly traded company. We're traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And I also say it was sort of a blessing because my other two offers were from Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae. And I almost went to Lehman. It was really close. But one of the benefits for me, sort of the silver lining of this financial turmoil, has been I always wanted to be on the business side,
but it's always difficult when you're doing very well mm-hmm. on the legal side for people to think about letting you transition. I said, well, we need you, you know, in the legal area. And so this really gave me an opportunity. I'd been at the company a few months and our chief risk officer left. And I ended up taking on that role in addition to being the chief legal officer. And that was just before the subprime meltdown. And so I sort of helped navigate the company through that time to really redo our risk culture. And so I think when it was time to have someone go into this role, then I became a choice that the CEO and the board felt comfortable with. So it was very fortunate for me that those circumstances happened the way they did. But I can't say that I actually sort of went after it. Mm,
okay. Kelly, we're living in an age of terrorism and severe cutbacks to law enforcement. And working for the FBI or CIA is still considered the pinnacle of a law enforcement career by many people. Yet others wonder whether honesty and integrity are still values that these organizations endorse because of the wide range of insider news that we've been privy to and the images that we've seen in the media, et cetera. So what advice would you give to any student who's considering a career in law enforcement, and particularly on the level of the FBI?
Thank you for that question, Stuart. By the way, I do want to put in a plug. I have some flyers over here you're welcome to pick up for careers in the FBI, both agent and support. Also have something on our honors intern program for college-age students, as well as graduate students, and we do hire some high school students as well. So pick up those.
Did you hire
older people? You're covered under the non-agent position, so yes.
Yeah.
We're going to hire you as well. For the agent position, you have to be, can be no older than 36, because we have to have you on board by 37, but you can be young as young as 23. If I were a student now, I would certainly one, going back to what our English professor has indicated, you need to be able to write. Because we put people in jail based on what we write, and you need to have an attention to detail, you need to be accurate. If you do sloppy work, we might hit the wrong house, we might put the wrong person in jail. Seriously, it's happened. So it's very important that you have to have the attention to detail, you have to be thorough. Now, we have several programs that you, under which you can enter, I mean, anywhere from language program to computer science, to physical sciences, to law, to accounting, military background. Intelligence is key, is big. The FBI has changed considerably since 9/11. It used to be, through the years, I would hear agents retire, they'd come back 2 or 3 years and say, you know, I really don't recognize this outfit. And I haven't left, and I don't recognize the outfit I joined. That's how much we have changed. So there's a big focus on intelligence. The FBI has always been good at collecting things and investigating cases, but it's always been after the fact. Something blows up, we're great about putting the piece together. But as far as gathering intelligence and putting together the pieces of the puzzle that's gonna help us prevent the next act of terrorism, that's our focus. So anybody that has an interest in intelligence, I think that's going to be a big key. I know in a down economy, things are kind of tight, but we are still hiring. We have an almost over $7 billion budget. And I think in cutbacks that we're going to see in years to come, the FBI is probably going to come out very well because, you know, right before 9/11, we barely had enough money to put gas in our cars. I mean, we were talking about parking cars and, you know, carpooling and doing these things. And when those towers went down, when the Pentagon was hit, and when the plane went down into the field, it's amazing the money got cut loose. So my view is pay me now, pay me later. And I think that we have to focus on our national defense, our national security, and somebody mentioned, Mike, you mentioned the internet. The internet is a great thing and it's a dangerous thing, especially for your kids. Be careful what they post out there because once it's out there, it's there. And people can use it for what we call social engineering. It's amazing the amount of information that people who seek to do you bad, do you harm, can get just by asking you questions based on reviewing what you have written. I mean, people will send me emails saying, hey, I've got some great pictures I'd love to show you of the wedding, but you need to be a friend. Well, if I need to be your friend to join up, I won't see them, so send them to me directly. So I will not be a member of Facebook. I will not engage in that because I realize the harm that can be done. I realize that the sexual and child exploitation, that these predators are out there and they prey on kids. Traveler cases that we also investigate, it's not a good thing. So use the internet, but use it cautiously. And another subject that we could get into, another topic, would be the state sponsors of cyber warfare. So it's great, but there are folks who are seeking to get our secrets. Like you wouldn't believe, it's much cheaper and easier for me to steal your hard R&D than to pay for it. So be careful getting what you put out there. Be careful who you hire. Make sure you've done some backgrounds, because most of the stuff that disappears is an insider threat. So Mike, all these great products you can develop, make sure you have the safeguards in place to ensure that stuff is protected, because if not, you're gonna see counterfeit products that look exactly like what you're making, but somebody else has done it for a fraction of the cost. And all I need to do is cite the jet strike fighter that the U.S. was in the process of developing, and lo and behold, the PRC unveils almost an exact replica. So guess what? We're back to square one. Folks, it's real out there, so that's what we're all about. So anyhow, these are the exciting things. If your kids or if you're interested, you're not too old. Granted, they're going to kick me out in 5 years, but I could certainly come back in a different role, you know, provided I get a waiver on my pension, if I can double dip, come back as a contractor. So either way, there's no set, clearly you have to have the education, you have to at a minimum have a BA or BS degree, you have to have various work experience, but depending on what area entry level you come into, and again, I will refer you to my flyer, they'll lay it all out, so the field is wide open.
Thank you, Kelly. McHugh, tell us, what is it like working every day with two Wahoos, Bert Ellis and Von Stanley, and what does this working relationship say about College Connections?
I think in general, if there's somebody from, if I get a resume and somebody's from UVA, it means they're probably pretty smart. I mean, it's a good starting point. I mean, I don't worry too much about even what their grade point average are, but somewhere along the way, there's a pretty good intellectual pedigree that got them to the university, and they managed to get out of the university with a degree. So I mean, that's a great starting point. They go to the top of the stack. And as I've gone into business with people, a lot of people don't want to work with friends, or they're afraid to work with friends. And I've worked with friends. John and I worked together at Mindspring, and I worked with two other guys who went to UVA. And the best thing in the world is to work with friends. I mean, as long as you can put aside some of the pettiness that comes, you know, with the day-to-day frustration, and realize that that's just, in any job, you're going to have that. Working with friends is great, so I would absolutely, I mean, there's a bunch of, not only is there a bunch of smart people in this room, I mean, you're a self-selecting group. I mean, the real train wrecks from our class don't come to the reunion, so. this is a great group to network with right here. I mean, you got all sorts of smart, talented people, So by all means, I would, you know, gear up the networking, get as many Virginia people as you can. My success has always been surround myself with smarter people, and in my case, that's almost anybody off the street. So it's been easy, but by all means, it's a heck of a pool to be selecting from. And the admission standards now for kids to get into UVA are off the scale. Who here thinks they could have gotten into UVA with current admission standards? I mean, it's really, really hard for folks to get in, and you know, we were awfully fortunate, and a kid makes it out now, they should have a leg up on a lot of other people out there looking for jobs. So I like working with Wahoos.
Okay. Let's do one more with Jahan, and I want you to talk a little bit more about Semester C. You had that opportunity to participate. You taught at various places worldwide. So go a little bit more into detail about the program, and where were some of the places you visited, and which was a favorite and why?
So, you know, for me, one of the most exciting things about teaching on Semester at Sea was not only that I got to, you know, take my kids, and my wife was also teaching as I was, and you know, but one of the areas that is not post-coital, but post-colonial studies, which basically means the study of, what we used to call kind of third world countries and their literatures. One of the things I've been really interested in the last 10, 15 years is, the kind of transnational or global connections among writers who read one another's work and are influenced by one another and the ways in which national boundaries don't really mean that much to them. So for me to be able to take my students to India, say, for example, and it's one thing to read Indian writers here in Charlottesville, but actually to be able to get off the ship and then go and meet some Indian writers and talk to them about their, the religious traditions out of which they're writing, or to be able to teach, say, a South African poet who writes about the experience of being on Robben Island and the incredible torment of doing the hard labor there, of breaking stones, the bleeding of the hands and the feet, this kind of thing. Again, it's a very different experience to do that in Charlottesville. I hope it's exciting and wonderful, but to then be able to take your students to Robben Island and to meet with a former inmate there, who actually is your functions as your tour guide, is really an extraordinary experience. So, we've talked, a number of us have talked about the global and globalization, and obviously UVA, one of the things we've been trying to do is ramp up the kind of global dimensions of the education that we offer. It seems to me that you can do that in certain ways in Charlottesville, but Semester at Sea is a wonderful way of achieving that as well, I think.
Thank you. Well, in the remaining minutes, I want to see if the audience has any questions for our panel. If you do, raise your hand and I'll call on you. Anyone?
I want to ask Kelly, are there any television shows that depict the FBI like it really is?
I have very little time to watch TV, so I'm not sure what all's out there, but probably some of the documentary shows that go back and look at cases, kind of the cold cases, and go back in history, they're probably more...
What about Silence of the Lambs?
Hannibal Lecter, I think?
Yeah, exactly. Not so much.
Not so much.
Any audience questions for our panel? Or if anyone in the audience would like to share something about what you've been doing the last 30 years that would be of interest to us, maybe help us as we think about our futures from here, come on. These guys have been on the spot for the last hour.
I want to ask, is anybody going into politics?
You're smart.
Yeah, I don't know if it's our class. I don't know. Maybe it is because we're too smart and it's just not effective to beat your head against the wall, but it kind of amazes me that we don't have sort of more classmates that are, running for office and stuff like that. It may just be we're too smart, but that's kind of amazing because I know first year in my, dorm and first year friends, everybody was pre-law and was going to be a senator, and I don't know, didn't pan out,
but Kelly,
I don't understand why not.
Actually, I had that interest. Somewhere along the way, things changed. And I think the FBI kind of depoliticized you because we have to be very apolitical. We can't run for office. We can't show any preference for any particular party. There is a young employee that I have mentored over the last few years who just got elected as a commissioner for one of the small cities there in Florida. But those are considered non-political. So you cannot run for an office, either Democrat or Republican. But believe it or not, I went with a classmate of ours, Woody Holton. Anybody remember Woody?
Yeah.
Whose father's former governor. And I went to the Republican State Convention. And it was kind of helping out support his dad somewhat, and who was not successful. But at that convention, that's when I started my alcohol drinking. I was nursing a bourbon and coke all night. I was at a party hosted by John Warner and Liz Taylor. And most of you may have remembered that John Warner was not the nominee. It was a guy by the name of Dick Openshain, very staunch conservative, part of the Godwin group, who was unfortunately killed in a plane crash on a campaign trip, and the party caucused, and John Warner was selected. And the rest is history. So I did have that interest, but as I left, and I remember leaving, and I guess it was 81, maybe it might have been 84, talking to Ernie Earn in his office in Rotunda, and basically saying that I had come to UVA very idealistic. I was going to change the world, but through my 4 years, through my 7 years, I realized there were limitations to that, and that I was somewhat wiser and also somewhat realistic and somewhat more disappointed that there were limitations. Notwithstanding the accomplishments of having been to UVA, there's still going to be limitations that you're going to have to deal with. And so somewhere along the way, politics, quite frankly, I'm kind of disillusioned with politicians. As you see what happens, depending on what side they're on, it's, it depends on which way the wind is blowing. So it's somewhat upsetting that, and that's what upsets me more about the workplace, that your motives should be based on the good of the country, the FBI, the citizens we serve, and not your own self-interest.
Teresa, you have a question?
I was just going to add that when I was in law school, one of my professors thought I should run for office. And, you know, it sort of was one of those things in the back of my mind. But as someone who's spent quite a bit of time on the Hill, I do quite a bit of lobbying. And as you can imagine, in the current environment when we're talking about financial services reform, I think I'm more and more disillusioned. I mean, I spend my time doing it because I believe that even if people make decisions that differ from what I think should happen, I'd rather for them to do it on the basis of information and being informed rather than doing it because they don't understand. But I think it's a process that you have to be willing to deal with a lot of things that probably aren't sort of in our genetics, particularly coming out of a culture like UVA's.
I think maybe we read some of Ron Suskin's books and decided that maybe politics isn't the right place to go.
Well, I think we are done, class. I want to thank you all. You've been a great audience. But before we do, I am very pleased to present on behalf of our class Tiffany's jewelry tonight.
It's a little bit UVA swag.
Yes, grab one. Thank you. Gift to each of our panelists. Thank you very much. Oh, names are on here. Okay. Here's Mike.
Airline mini models.
Thank you all again very much.
Yeah, apparently they're individual to each one of us. Mine's airline mini models. What do you call that?
I have lottery tickets. Thank you all very much.